May it please the court, my name is Thames Fowler, and with me at council tables is Lane Lawrence from the Bidinelli Law Firm. We represent Sheila Windhorst, plaintiff below, appellant here. Registration number is 15983. Overview of the argument I present today, we had a summary judgment ruling on insurance contract. It's a UM case. We've got a summary judgment grant of with regard to the insurance company State Farm's motion for summary judgment on non-cooperation. Likewise, on the flip side, we have a grant based on summary judgment in favor of State Farm on plaintiff's bad faith claim. It was a common law bad faith claim. There are basically three areas which plaintiff Windhorst believes the trial court erred. First of all, there was a fundamental legal error in the court's view of the case. The court held and decided that in the first party context, Alcorn, the famous case dealing with processing privileged matters and where the privilege law would be developed, it's all been briefed, did not apply. Therefore, the trial court viewed Windhorst's resistance to signing blank or broad and sweeping releases or medical authorizations was improper. The next area is the trial court invaded the province of the jury, made various findings of fact on disputed evidence. And finally, the third error is related to that, in that the trial court viewed all the evidence proffered and really in favor of State Farm and afforded no reasonable inferences to Windhorst. Turning to the primary legal issue, it's really a fundamental public policy issue. State Farm contended and fought, and it frankly became a tug of war between counsel for Windhorst, Mr. Bendinelli in the trial court, and Mr. Levy, whether or not Alcorn and that process would apply in a first party context.
Why is that issue still before us, given the fact that trial counsel and State Farm seemed ultimately to have agreed to proceed on the basis that plaintiff's counsel would produce relevant records or a privilege log if there was any objection, and State Farm agreed to go forward on that basis? In fact, I think in your brief you say that your opening brief says State Farm has waived that issue.
In essence, it has, in part, as far as causation and materiality, as far as the breach, the alleged breach of the duty of non-cooperation goes. But, Your Honor, the trial court's order and analysis still relied on its finding. In fact, its order states, the court finds plaintiff's reliance on Alcon is misplaced. Nowhere in Alcon did the Colorado Supreme Court hold that an insured could ignore or disregard the clear contractual obligations, such as submitting to a state examination under oath of the medical releases. That's in the trial court's order at page 1787 in the record.
But given that we're reviewing de novo, so it doesn't really matter what the trial court held, why doesn't our de novo review of the record show that this issue, the Alcorn issue, has been waived by both parties on the basis that they chose to proceed exchanging medical records?
Because the court viewed the evidence through that lens, Your Honor. The court decided and viewed all the conduct based on Windhorst and Windhorst counsel through that lens, that they can't resist appropriately signing blanket releases. That's my answer, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yep. There's little doubt dealing with Colorado law, and in fact, in the trial court, both parties debated at length in the various letters back and forth whether Alcon would apply or not. And in the briefing, it's interesting that State Farm, in its answer brief, continues to assert that Alcon would not apply in the first party context, particularly in the answer brief at pages 25 and 27. They continue to argue that Alcon would not apply in the first party context. There's three cases that really illustrate that that's incorrect. The most cogent case is Stone versus State Farm, announced by the Colorado Supreme Court in 2008. What's ironic is when the trial court concludes there's no evidence of possible bad faith, the trial court doesn't take into account the inference, at least the inference, that State Farm has taken the position it can ask for sweeping releases and Alcorn does not apply, when in 2008 State Farm was involved in litigation where the Supreme Court said no. They reaffirmed the Alcorn test. They applied it in a UM context. That's bad faith. Certainly that's an inference of bad faith that the trial court did not afford Windhorst. That's error.
Mr. Fowler, I could not help but, as I went through this, feeling like this was a sideshow. I mean, the case is whether there's coverage, and here State Farm is asking for certain documents, and your client has every reason to produce documents that will enable her insurer to review her claim, and for some reason on your side of the case you decided to start drawing lines, and all of a sudden the case was no longer about insurance coverage. Now it was about who can have what. It just seemed to me to be a sideshow. Why is this such a big deal in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's the integrity of the medical privilege created by statute. Of course, that's 1390.107.1b that says there's certain relationships that should be held inviolate, and one of them is, of course, the doctor-patient relationship. That public policy is articulated by the General Assembly first. Secondly, it's articulated by the Supreme Court in Alcon. Therefore, and even though it's a first-party context, even though Mrs. Windhorst paid premiums for years in advance of making the claim and having performed by paying premiums, that doesn't mean she gives up her right to confidentiality and her medical privilege across the board for any kind of care she may have had because she was involved in a motor vehicle accident.
Well, at the same time, it would seem that she would have to produce documents that relate to the same parts of her body.
Well, Your Honor, you're correct.
But didn't you resist producing those at the front end that no, the request was too broad and therefore we won't produce these, and in effect sheltered documents?
Yes and no. No, in the sense that the first battle line and tug of war that developed between the parties was whether or not the scope of the release demanded by State Farm complied at all with the policy language in the policy as far as providing a medical release or otherwise. And may I address that right now, Your Honor? If you compare, the court in its order set out the basic policy provisions with regard to the UM uninsured motorist endorsement. Clearly, the insured's duties were to provide written authorization for us, State Farm, to obtain medical bills, medical records, and other information they deem necessary to substantiate the claim. But if you look at the actual authorization, that's that quote of the policy language is at 1786 in the trial court's order. If you look at, in our opening brief, Exhibit D, was the actual authorization of release of information that State Farm demanded. They didn't ask, they demanded this. And there's three key problems. First of all, the authorization is broad. It covers all medical conditions whatsoever. It's not accident-related medical provisions. Secondly, it says, quote, information obtained pursuant to this authorization may later be redisclosed and may not be protected under the HIPAA privacy rule, end of quote.
So did trial counsel raise that objection below in all these back and forth exchanges with State Farm?
Yes, in a general sense. The issue was preserved. They said, no, Alcon applies. We won't sign these releases.
I'm sorry. My question was a little bit different. Perhaps I asked it poorly. Did Ms. Windhorst's counsel below specifically say to State Farm that the provision you just read is objectionable?
I don't believe they said redisclosure itself was wrong in the course and conduct of the letters back and forth pre-litigation. Once the litigation began, I believe they articulated that. The other problem with the breadth of the release, this information may also be released to insurance companies for their use in connection with insurance transactions. So therefore, State Farm can put it out on an insurance bureau, report it to other companies at their whim. That serves no purpose in this case. It doesn't help Ms. Windhorst. That's a violation of her rights under medical privilege. That's why there's Alcorn.
So requesting authorization and signature on this release, that's bad faith?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, because it doesn't even comport with the terms of the policy. This goes far beyond. It's redisclosure to the world without any real purpose other than to benefit the insurance companies to the extent it might. And the other is that there's going to be redisclosure to other insurance companies. And the last one is they can basically walk through your medical records at their whim.
No. Mr. Fowler, yes. If indeed State Farm then agreed to only ask for the relevant documents that Ms. Windhorst was willing to disclose, then what happens with that bad faith claim?
That would certainly be more narrow. There wouldn't be the evidentiary basis based on the overreaching, based on the face of the release, Your Honor. And that's one of the primary problems that the plaintiff asserted as far as bad faith. And one point I want, does that answer your question, Your Honor? As the court analyzes, I'm sure it has already, when we're talking about the summary judgment on the non-disclosure side, okay, a non-cooperation side, that's their burden to prove. That's not the plaintiff, Ms. Windhorst's. Okay, so we're entitled all the favorable inferences in every respect. And all those letters that went back and forth clearly articulated the problem of Alcorn first. I'm down to 3 minutes. I'd like to try to reserve at least 3 minutes if I could. Let me make just a couple other comments. So the court viewed summary judgment through the wrong legal lens, if you will. We've compared the language in the release to that in the policy, and it doesn't match up. That's bad faith, particularly given Stone. They knew Alcon should apply in a first-party context. That's, of course, an inference at least that there was bad faith. Now, as far as a material breach of the duty to cooperate, number one, as the court's well aware, that breach of the duty, which State Farm has to prove that there's no dispute, material issue, disputed fact, that they've proffered that, there's no evidence from which an adverse inference could be drawn. And if two inferences can be drawn from the same evidence, one favorable and one disfavorable, the favorable inference has to be afforded the non-moving party, Windhorst. That's basic. But it's a question of fact as to whether there was non-compliance or non-cooperation. We cited several cases, Farmers Auto, Insurance Exchange, Congress, I believe is how you say that, Hansen versus Barmore, all that. But the key thing is the resistance to the broad releases was justified. The trial court held that against Windhorst in its order granting summary judgment in favor of State Farm. Secondly, the trial court held the examination under oath against Windhorst. And you can look at, and anyone can read that transcript. It was highly contentious. There's no question about it at the examination under oath. But the thing is, in litigation, State Farm took Ms. Windhorst's deposition. So again, there's really a causal break between the pre-litigation conduct and whether there was any substantial material impact on State Farm's abilities to adjust the claim. One key point is State Farm never paid a dime based on any false information or lack of information. How can they be prejudiced in a real sense when they collected the premium at the front end and then they're just not satisfied with the documents and the resistance to give a blanket release at the back end? They really aren't prejudiced. I'd like to reserve my 1.5 seconds if I could. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Mark Levy here representing State Farm. And as you all can see from looking at the record, I was actually a participant in some of these matters. First of all, I'd like to address, I think, Judge Carparelli, your comment about this being a sideshow. It's exactly kind of what it was, but it wasn't a sideshow. It was a direct issue with respect to making the insurance claim. As can be seen from the record, State Farm is trying from minute one. State Farm gets notice of this accident in 2008. It was 2011 when the summary judgment was granted. State Farm went through huge machinations, letter after letter after letter, spent thousands and thousands of dollars on attorney's fees trying to get very simple cooperation with the question of, we think you're making an uninsured motorist claim. Exactly how have you been injured? Exactly what is your claim about so that we can address the claim? There is currently a lot of debate going on about whether or not an insurance carrier is required to do an investigation before a claim for money damages is owed. For example, if an insured submits and says, I've been involved in an accident, there may be a claim. Is the insurance company required at that point to do an investigation and begin it, et cetera? That's not really what we're about here. What we're talking about here is State Farm wanted to do that investigation. State Farm got notice of an issue, got notice of a claim, got notice of an insured where they claimed that there might be an uninsured motorist claim. I'm jumping ahead hugely here, but the case was not in litigation when we asked for the examination under oath. What happened was, after letter after letter after letter, and one thing I want to point out here is I think the counsel is continuing the fiction about what this case is really about. You've heard over and over here with this argument about it's about the scope of the release. Well, not only was the scope of the release never raised, this idea about being able to reproduce it to other people and other insurers and things like that, I would like to point the court to, I don't have the record on appeal citation to this, but it was Exhibit K to our summary judgment motion, and it was our interrogatories to Ms. Windhorst. And at interrogatory number four, we essentially said, what is the bad faith that you are alleging in this case? And never once were we told that the bad faith included the scope of that particular release. And this is dated January 4th, 2011. So we start off here with a request, a very simple request from the claims person to say, please tell us the particulars about your automobile accident, about your injuries. And then there's this focus in response from Mr. Beninelli's office of, oh, you can't do that, Alcon Spicer, et cetera, which was a smokescreen, which was a delay tactic intended to, and in fact, essentially did, run out the clock. We're 2 months before our ultimate trial when the summary judgment is granted. We still don't have the information we're asking for, except we found out from co-counsel who had the 2007 automobile accident, the automobile accident right before ours, he had all these Kaiser records. So he showed us these Kaiser records that demonstrated not only were there material information that was being intentionally withheld, but folks, with all due respect, there's nothing else to call it except fraud. They were trying to fraudulently make this insurance claim. And this is what Mr. Beninelli's office did. You can see letter after letter, we address these questions. Would you please do X? Would you please do Y? Mr. Timms mentions this, you want this overbroad release. We asked for the names of your treating doctors as a result of the automobile accident. That's all very simply. They wouldn't give us those either. And it was one excuse after another. We won't come to an examination under oath because of Rule 27. Rule 27 has nothing to do with an examination under oath. So back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, but we didn't set up the examination under oath until Mr. Beninelli then sent in a letter said, please give us your money. Please send us the policy limits. We're now making a demand for the entirety of the policy limits. So when that happened, we said, okay, we'll do an examination under oath and find out what your injuries are. And then we go through that whole debacle. And you can take a look at the transcript on that examination under oath. You can see what Judge Kuznowski said about it. But essentially, Mr. Beninelli would not allow that to occur. It wasn't a matter of just, gee whiz, I'm videotaping the examination under oath. Mr. Beninelli is running all around the table. Mr. Beninelli won't let his client answer a question. You can see in that transcript, I keep trying to ask some relevant questions about her claim. And it's just disruptive, disruptive, disruptive. And if you run out the clock long enough, then you get to trial. You're able to perpetrate and complete this fraudulent activity. You're able to present it to a jury, and perhaps you're able to score some money. But in the meantime, you have sitting on your desk these records that you know are relevant, that even if you apply Alcon, you're required to tell us about them. We got a letter from Mr. Beninelli's office that said there are no pre-accident neck or back injury treatments. And folks, it's undisputedly untrue. That was an untruthful letter.
Now, if lawyers are willing to do that, then you can get away with a lot, because look at what we had to go through to get to this point here. And had we not had co-counsel with the Kaiser records, I mean, I'm wondering whether that ever would have been disclosed. But as you can see, is this pattern from Mr. Benendali's office over and over and over again to run out the clock, to delay, delay, delay. Now, one of the reasons that this is a complete and total smokescreen on this issue about the scope of the release is one of the things we did. First of all, I want to point out, and this is a record from our summary judgment exhibit E, and it is 413 of the record on appeal. And in addition to the giving authorizations, the policyholder is required to notify us of the claim and give us all the details about the death, injury, treatment, and other information that we may need as soon as reasonably possible after the injured insured is first examined or treated, et cetera, et cetera. And then also provide written authorization. So one of the things that State Farm asked for is just, okay, tell us the list of doctors whom we treated with, so that we can go ahead and do our investigation. Because at some point, what ultimately happens with this is the plaintiff's attorney comes in, says, okay, here's my demand. You now have 20 days or 30 days. We want you to pay the bills. And we don't have the records. And we've been trying like crazy to get the records. And that's why the examination under oath was set up.
How long did this fight over this form release continue?
To the bitter end. I mean, I'm going to say... I disagreed with calling it a fight over the form release, because what happened was the State Farm, and it was all my letterhead, but it wasn't I doing it. It was another attorney in my office named Mark Carlson, who had been a former staff attorney at State Farm. But he kept writing over and over, kind of, and made several offers of compromise. And that's one I really want to point out here on the record on appeal at page 402. After going through 8.5 pages of discussion about this and debate with Mr. Bendinelli about what's required or not required, et cetera, whether it is or... I think this whole idea of does Alcon, does that require the... does that do something to this insurance authorization language and requirement, as the federal court found in Harris, I think it's not a valid point. It hasn't been preserved, and it's not sort of an issue in this case, and here's one of the reasons why. Because what Mr. Carlson then did, and this is September 30th, 2008, we're 2.5 years. This battle goes on afterwards. It says, request under your client's duty to cooperate. Assign medical authorization form for State Farm's consideration involving what you consider to be all relevant medical records. If you object to that definition in any way, please advise me of each part you object to and the case law you have to support your objection. Please provide any form of authorization that you believe complies with the law and your client's obligations for State Farm review and consideration.
What's the date of that?
That is September 30th, 2008, and it is again at page 402 of the record. So we're saying, okay, let's not play these games with this stupid debate on this whole thing. Just give us what you think is required. It was completely and totally ignored because Mr. Bendinelli did not want to do this. Mr. Bendinelli wanted to continue to hide the ball. There's a reference that in the opening brief, they cite to Bischelli versus State Farms, another case with Mr. Bendinelli and myself, where Mr. Bendinelli testified at a deposition that this is his office practice, that he will not produce records till he decides he wants.
Excuse me, counsel, is this in our record, what you're saying?
It was in the brief. It was referenced in the briefs, Your Honor.
Okay.
So it is referenced in the briefs.
But is it in our record that we can review this?
I believe we mentioned it in our brief, Your Honor. I don't think we attached copies of that deposition transcript. I'll move on. So that was number one. Give us any medical records authorization form that you think is appropriate. We'll be happy to consider that. Number two, a list of the names, addresses, and telephone numbers and specialties of all medical providers who have treated and or are treating your client for the alleged injury she sustained in the subject automobile accident. What's wrong with that? That's not addressed, but it has nothing to do with Alcon. All we're asking for is give us the name of all of the treaters who have treated your client as a result of this automobile accident. How is that in any way violative? And it's not. Mr. Bendinelli kept saying it was, or Ms. Albano kept saying it was, because that was the drill, to just keep arguing, arguing, arguing. I'm willing to advise the court here that the plaintiff's counsel, whether it was Mr. Bendinelli or Ms. Albano, simply did not respond to our correspondence. Now, there were letters that were sent. There were letters that purported to respond, not to all of them, but to some of them. But they didn't, because they kind of danced around the issue. So again, September 2008, there was this request for any form of authorization you consider will be okay, and we'll take it and we'll go from there and we'll start there. Number two, the names, address of all the treaters. Number three, medical records. Send us medical records that your firm asserts are, quote, all relevant medical records as of the date of the production. And this says, at this time, because of your client's current failure to cooperate, State Farm will hold its investigation and evaluation of your client's UIM claim in abeyance during such 30 days. Again, there was no response.
Mr. Levy, just to clarify, this letter that you're referring to, the September 30th, wasn't that in response to a response from Ms. Windhorst's attorney that she would give relevant documents at the appropriate juncture?
Correct. That's what she told us. So we said, okay, please provide them. And she didn't. Again, they told us things that simply were not factually accurate. They told us they would provide all relevant medical records. And then we get to the punchline where they do their settlement demand, which I believe was in March of 2009, and they do their settlement demand, and they don't provide all relevant records. They don't mention this earlier auto accident. If we didn't know about this earlier auto accident from other sources, we would not know it occurred. The settlement demand letter just says she was injured in this automobile accident, and therefore you should pay her policy limits. Now, we know there's another accident. And then again, that's when we did the EEO, so we could find out about it. We made several requests for the EEO, and it's not just, you know, I do reject this notion that if we are ignored often and often enough, and then they finally show up, then that means they have cured all of the places where they ignored us. But I sent several letters trying to set up this EEO, again, to cut through this entire stuff so we can get right to it, ask Ms. Windhorst these questions, find out what information we know or need to know or don't know, and then move on with the handling of the claim. We are 2 months before trial when the summary judgment is granted, and we still do not have the information we need to evaluate the claim, to come up to it with an evaluation of the insurance claim. And that's why there's clearly no bad faith here. This idea that asking for a release authorization is bad faith, there's no evidence to support any of that. Bad faith requires not only that we take an unreasonable position, do something unreasonably, but that we know it's unreasonable or recklessly disregard that it's unreasonable. And there's nothing been pointed out here again except stuff just what I'm going to say is a smokescreen. Judge Kasnusi was very specific about the fact that we provided... pursuant to Rule 56, we provided affidavits of facts. We provided and responses to discovery, et cetera, et cetera. Responses to discovery, please admit you had these Kaiser records. Yes, we admit it. Please admit you didn't produce before a certain date. Yes, we admit it. And so literally 2 months before trial, I'm taking this Windhorst deposition in a vacuum because we still don't have the materials that we think that obviously are out there and that we're entitled to have. So what I would like to reiterate here and point out here is in addition to those items from the record on appeal, paragraph 11 from Judge Kuznewski's orders, these are factual findings, paragraph 20 and paragraph 21. I think are all very relevant to this entire matter. And then again, even if you take it out of this whole idea that this is about the scope of the release, and if it was about the scope of the release and that had to be raised at the beginning, but it's not, because there are these other requests for cooperation for just basic data. And at the end of the day, this is not some sort of gotcha game. This is a game of, this is not even a game, I don't mean game, but this is a scenario where the insurance company is entitled to information to know whether or not the claim should be paid. And one item of prejudice that just everybody sort of overlooks is that when you don't pay the claim, you get sued for bad faith. And then you get sued for bad faith, you have to defend that and go through all of this. This is a case that may have been able to be resolved had appropriate information been provided. And throughout all of this, it wasn't. And with all due respect, what State Farm got in return was one dog ate my homework excuse after another, all to justify running out the clock so we can then go to trial and you won't have all the records to either evaluate the case or to be able to defend it if appropriate. That's violative of what's required by the Supreme Court from Brecky, and et cetera. And I have 18 seconds left. Are there any questions? Thank you all very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Please, sir. I'll make several very short points because my time is limited. One, State Farm's arguing clean hands. State Farm was actually the party in Stone, and Stone clearly held that Alcon applies in the UM context. Therefore, for State Farm to claim they have good, clean hands is preposterous. The tug of war started over the releases because they said Alcorn did not apply, signed these blanket releases that went far beyond the policy language, violated Alcorn. Two, the different form argument. They came to plaintiffs supposedly and said, oh, gee, Ms. Windhorst, just do a release on a form you find acceptable. Well, that won't work under Alcorn. Given the checkerboard pattern of medical care, you couldn't custom craft a release that would cover that. You had to go through the Alcorn process in order to screen out the irrelevant medical records and preserve the privilege. That was why it was resisted.
Go ahead, continue.
Thank you. He mentions interrogatory number 4. There was a long list in the response to interrogatory number 4 is the listing of all the correspondence that Ms. Windhorst and counsel asserted demonstrated bad faith. That sets forth the arguments about Alcorn and the rest of the conduct. So he says there's absolutely nothing in interrogatory 4. Check the record on that, Your Honors. Please.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case is deemed submitted and counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.